Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another exciting edition of Riding the Storm Out. Today, I've got in studio Dr. Mark Newman, and we're going to be talking about abortion. Stay tuned. Well, today is a very special day as we have an actual guest in studio. And Dr. Mark Newman has a PhD in rhetorical studies. That means making up a lot of baloney in articulate terms. There was different terminology in the locker room, Mark, but we'll just say baloney today. And also taught rhetoric at Regent University. And Mark is the founder and president of Speaker for Life. And I've just had the privilege of knowing you for about the last 3 or 4 months, but you've become a friend very quickly. And, of course, I believe one of the most articulate, knowledgeable defenders on the subject of life. So, Mark, welcome to our program today.
It's great to be here.
We're going to be speaking to a lot of people and primarily a lot of pastors. So hopefully I'll ask the right questions and we can inform them a little bit. Of course, over the last year, one of the most talked about things in the life issue was that Roe versus Wade had been reversed, the Dobbs decision. So what is the state of abortion now in the United States of America?
We are currently in what I would call the Missouri Compromise phase of this war. So people have this idea, right? Roe versus Wade got overturned. A lot of people think, oh, abortion's illegal now. Well, not remotely. What we now have are literally we have life states and we have death states. So, for example, the state that I moved to, Tennessee is a life state. Abortion is essentially illegal throughout the state. States like California, they went ahead and just doubled down, not just in terms of ideology, but in terms of action. So as I shared last night at a apologetics class, they produced these documents called the Future of Abortion Council. Governor Newsom, the governor of California, put these together. In December of 2021, they released this report. It had 45 recommendations. I believe that at last time I checked, about 24 of them had already been made into law. Governor Newsom put $200 million into a budget for increased abortion access. These guys, they want to forgive student loans for doctors and other medical personnel who are willing to perform abortions. I mean, it's mind-blowing. But they weren't done. So in December 2022, they added an addendum with a lot more. So they're roaring forward.
They're creating an industry for their state, bringing people to California. It's a destination for death.
That's correct, yeah.
So of all the states, what is the most life-honoring state? I know there's been a lot of talk this last week. We had the presidential candidates in Iowa and the conversation about the six-week heartbeat bill.
Yes.
Is Iowa leading the way? Who's leading the way on this?
Well, since I moved to Tennessee, I'm going to have to tell you, I think Tennessee is leading the way. Tennessee virtually has—and I want to make it clear, Tennessee hasn't restricted abortions. Texas hasn't restricted abortions. What Tennessee and Texas have done is they have created life-affirming laws. Their job is they've created laws that are designed to protect innocent life, which is what the law should do. The media is constantly saying things like, oh, these horrible, terrible, restrictive abortion laws, as if abortion should be something anybody should be able to go out and get at any time. The fact of the matter is we have states where we have governments and legislators and governors and legislators stepping up, crafting and signing bills designed to protect innocent life in the womb. And that's how that argument needs to be framed.
And fundamentally, the Declaration of Independence, the first unalienable right was the right to life.
That's
you cannot
correct.
Have your life arbitrarily taken from you unless you break some law or something happens in that case.
That's correct.
And this is certainly, by definition, the killing, taking of innocent life.
Yes.
So with the six-week heartbeat bill, doesn't that basically – I know there's those abolitionists out there, and quite frankly, we're eye-to-eye on most things. Killing the child is never the right answer.
That's correct.
But does the six-week heartbeat bill that really would kind of eliminate? Because most of the time, a woman doesn't even know she's pregnant until about four or five weeks. Is that right?
Till past 6 weeks normally, it takes a while.
So by the time she's aware of it and would take the test, the heartbeat's
there's
already
a heartbeat
there.
Already there. That's correct.
So basically that would, in effect, eliminate abortion.
Essentially, yes. But the key here is, I'll get back to the abolitionist thing. Okay. We're all abolitionists, right? People, my friend Scott Klusendorf, myself, John Ensor, we're all abolitionists. And what I mean by that is all of us have as an ultimate goal the end of abortion in America. The folks out there that identify themselves as abolitionists, what they are immediatists.
Yeah.
They believe that they should be able to just step in and make all abortion illegal tomorrow because, after all, you know, they're human beings. You're not allowed to murder human beings. Therefore, right. we should be able to stop this now.
Logically, it makes sense. Yeah.
But the problem is the strategies and the tactics necessary to make that happen aren't there. Mm-hmm. So what is the value of a six-week heartbeat bill? Well, every time we bring the standard down. So let's say, for example, in some states, it's 15 weeks. In some states, it's 20 weeks. By the way, a 20-week abortion ban barely stops any abortions at all. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to still count that as a win because it does stop some abortions. And then what it does is it allows someone like me to come in and say, hey, why stop abortions at 20 weeks?
Right.
And why not 19 weeks? What is the significant difference, developmentally even, between a 19-week and a 20-week-old fetus? And the fact of the matter is, our opponents, they cannot tell you what that is. As a matter of fact, they have a hard time determining when human life begins at any rate. So our job is to come in and use whatever laws are in place as a platform to show people the logical conclusions of those arguments. And the fact of the matter is, whenever you're talking about human life, it's very important that we have a bright line distinction between who is and is not included in the kind of human life that we protect. There is only one bright line that exists, and that's conception. Mm-hmm. Before conception, the man's sperm is his cell. The woman's egg, that's her cell. But when those two cells fuse together, you don't have a fertilized egg, right? That doesn't exist. What you have is a new human being. That human being's got its own DNA, or his or her own DNA. That human being is going to conduct their own or organize their own development. Mm-hmm. That organism is going to plant, right? That child is going to plant inside the mother's uterus. The mom's going to provide nutrition, hydration, a safe place to live, waste removal services, and that child is going to grow. From the moment of conception until old age, it's the same human being. Mm-hmm. So you are the same human being you were on the first day that you were created. The DNA that was in that cell is the DNA that is now in every cell in your body, and that zygote, what Moore, Prasad, and Torsia, they wrote a embryology textbook called The Developing Human, Clinically Oriented Embryology, and they identify conception as the beginning of each and every one of our individual lives.
Well, you know, what was interesting is I've gone through your apologetics conference, mm-hmm. and you held up some props, and one of the props was a Planned Parenthood tract, basically, from the 50s, and they themselves define life beginning at conception. So, yeah, there you go right there.
I always come prepared. So this is
the camera view. Yeah.
This is a brochure called The Gift of Life. If you notice carefully, you will see that it looks like people going to or coming from church. This was published in 1951. In it, they write, if one of the male sperm meets and unites with an egg cell, a new life begins. Mm-hmm. This brochure was distributed by the Planned Parenthood Federation of America. Everybody knows when human life begins. That was in 1951. Then, before and after that, they had this brochure. It's called Plan Your Children for Health and Happiness. You can look on the back, and it says, every child a wanted child, right? That's Planned Parenthood's slogan. And it says right here, this pamphlet distributed by the Planned Parenthood Federation of America. Well, I have a photocopy of this brochure. It's about birth control. They asked the question, birth control, is it an abortion? Listen to what Planned Parenthood told women prior to Roe versus Wade. They say, definitely not. An abortion kills the life of a baby after it has begun. It is dangerous to your life and health. It may make you sterile so that when you want a child, you cannot have it. This is what, so Planned Parenthood used to tell everybody.
That was the human truth, life. At least.
Yes. That was the truth. Human life begins at conception.
Yeah.
And abortion kills the life of a baby after it's begun. So the question we need to ask Planned Parenthood is, why did you change? What happened? Mm-hmm. Did we get some new medical technology that helped us to see better, for example, inside the womb? Did that convince you? Oh, oops, no. We have ultrasound, which just confirms the life of the unborn child.
More evidence.
Absolutely. We have 3D ultrasound. We have it's unbelievable the technology we have. I mean, back in the day, maybe you saw that Life magazine cover that showed children in the womb of their parents. It was old, from the 1970s, I believe. And yet here we have a group of people backing off of this position. Why? I can only think of two reasons: money and political power. Abortion is a multi-million dollar business. It's a business. Now, they'll tell you, oh, we're nonprofit. Folks, 97% of women who walk into Planned Parenthood pregnant, the service they get from Planned Parenthood is an abortion. And you can parse that out using their own statistics. So this lie out there, oh, it's only 3% of the work that we do. They're using radical accounting tricks to come to that number. Pregnant women, what do they offer pregnant women? They offer them abortions.
One of the things they Planned Parenthood does, they try to depersonalize what's going on. This is not, they try to make it not a human being. It's just a clump of cells. What is the distinction between using the word person versus the word human being as far as Planned Parenthood is concerned?
Well, here's the deal. I think people gave up a long time ago. Anybody who's actively debating this issue publicly gave up a long time ago on making the argument that what's in a woman's body is not a human being. Now, I want to make it clear. Planned Parenthood still tries to sell that on their website.
Even though they admitted back here that it was killing a child.
Absolutely. Now, when they talk about, for example, they describe aspiration abortion to the people who are coming to look for their services, and they won't even mention the unborn child at all. They'll refer to the unborn child as pregnancy tissue, right? Now, if you've ever dealt with other kinds of conditions in your life, like anxiety, for example, there's no doctor that's going to come and perform surgery on you to remove your anxiety tissue, right? Because anxiety is a condition.
Right.
It's not a thing. So we've got Planned Parenthood basically completely ignoring the existence of the unborn child. But in a public debate, they will never do that. Why? Well, because we have mountains of evidence to demonstrate the humanity of the unborn child. So what they do then is they go, okay, well, so let's lay out the pro-life case for people. It's wrong to intentionally kill an innocent human being. Abortion intentionally kills an innocent human being. Therefore, abortion is wrong. Everybody will stipulate that first claim, right? Everybody will go, yes, it's wrong to intentionally kill an innocent human being. And as I tell people, if they won't agree, move away slowly,
yeah.
Right? Where people give you pushback, right, is the idea that abortion intentionally kills an innocent human being. But we just demonstrated using an embryology textbook, using Planned Parenthood's own material, that human life begins at conception. So they don't say that anymore. So now what they say is, well, okay, well, it is a human being, but it's not like it's a person or anything. So all of the arguments for personhood tend to fall into four categories, and these were developed by a philosopher by the name of Stephen Schwartz in a book called The Moral Question of Abortion. He said, look, we look at size, level of development, environment, and degree of dependency. So this forms an acronym called SLED. Okay? By size, they say, well, look, it's too small, can't be a human being. By level of development, it doesn't have all the things we associate with a person's personality, right? They don't form relationships. They can't walk, talk. They aren't having deep thoughts. And what about environment, right? They're actually inside another person's body. So where they are determines that they're not a person. And then finally, this idea of degree of dependency, the idea there is viability, right? Because you can't live on your own outside the womb, therefore you don't count as one of us. The problem is all four of these standards put every post-born human being at risk. Mm-hmm. How big is big enough to count as a human being, right? They say, oh, that's just a clump of cells. I got news for you. You're a clump of cells. I'm a clump of cells. Mm-hmm. We're a highly organized clump of cells, but so are unborn children, highly organized clumps of cells. They are, in fact, organizing themselves while they are growing inside their mother's womb. So it's a very bad standard. And you can't say, you know, how big is big enough? I commented, I wrote a Bible study years ago with A.C. Green and met him. He's huge. He's the Laker basketball player. Yeah. But he may be more valuable than I am on a basketball court, but he's not more valuable than I am in terms of my ability to live. And his wife is like, I don't know, 5 foot tall, and she's not less valuable than he is. Size is a terrible standard to use. What about the standard of a level of development? All of us are differently developed. 20-year-old young men, the two hemispheres of their brain have not zipped together yet. They aren't fully developed. An 8-year-old girl does not have a fully developed reproductive system. Mm-hmm. That doesn't make her less valuable than her 18-year-old sister. Mm-hmm. What about environment? Okay, inside the body, outside the body. Some of you have seen the photographs of physicians doing surgery on children in the womb. So they open up that woman's abdomen, and you may have seen the famous photograph, the hand coming out and grabbing hold of the finger of the surgeon, right? According to these folks, while it was in the womb, not a person. Suddenly, hand out, oh, person. And then when they stuff them back in, not a person, right? Nothing magical happens during a 7-inch journey down a birth canal that suddenly magically transforms you from not a person to a person. So we don't determine what something is based on its environment. And then finally, this idea of degree of dependency. We actually have laws in this country that protect people who are weak and vulnerable, unless you're in the womb. If you're in the womb, then you're fair game, right? But all of us can become weak and vulnerable at any time. Slip on the ice, suddenly you're going to be 10 years old for the rest of your life. But some people, they are born with autism, with Down syndrome. We don't put people to death because they're dependent. As a matter of fact, we protect them. And there's a great example in that book that Stephen Schwartz wrote. He said, imagine if somebody walked into a neonatal intensive care unit filled with incubators with children in them, and then went by and systematically began strangling each one of the children in that incubator. He says, we would call that person a moral monster. Why then is it okay for us to kill children in the incubator of his or her mother's womb? So size, level of development, environment, degree of dependency, these are all terrible standards because they literally put all post-born people at risk. We're all of different sizes, right? We're all of different levels of ability and development. We are all in different environments all the time, and we are all to varying degrees dependent. As a matter of fact, if you live long enough, I guarantee you, you are going to become more and more dependent.
Start out in diapers, you wind up in diapers.
That's correct. Yeah. Alasdair MacIntyre, a famous Catholic philosopher, said, we're born as irrational, dependent creatures. We grow up, God willing, into independent, rational creatures, and then, God willing, if you keep all your marbles, when you get really old, you become a rational, dependent creature, and the circle of life, so to speak, is the people in the middle take care of the people at the margins. So we raise our young people up to be competent caregivers, and then when they become old, their kids are raised up, and they care for their elders.
And that was the biblical mandate.
Absolutely.
To take care of your children, supposed to take care of your seniors, your parents, honoring your parents.
Absolutely.
You know, one of the things that the other side does is they dehumanize, depersonalize. So it's when they try to desensitize us by saying it's just a clump of cells or something like that. One of the things that you point out in your classes is that when an abortion is actually done, they will take out every piece of a baby, and the doctor must account for every piece. And literally from, what is it, from 10 weeks on, it's a fully developed human being, in eyes, 10 fingers, 10 toes.
Yes.
But it's just small, just grows bigger after that. But the doctor will actually take out the hands, the arms, the head, every piece, and has to construct it in the tray. Because if he leaves a part of the body in there, then the woman can get very sick, even
That's
die.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a human being. One of the things you talked about last night that I had not considered was what happens when a woman orders a mail order at home, takes a pill to force an abortion at home. What will that woman expect to see if she does that?
Well, here's the problem with the abortion pill. For starters, surgical abortion, it's no longer the majority of abortions which occur in the United States.
Okay.
People have suggested that upwards of 60 to 70% of all abortions now are conducted using an abortion pill. Laws vary state to state on how you can get them and how much supervision taking that pill requires. But the bottom line is it's a series of two pills. And I want to make something really clear to anybody watching this, especially pastors. If you happen to run into a woman and she says, oh, I took the first pill and now I don't want to go through with it, there is an abortion. There is an abortion pill reversal protocol, which is there have been some attorneys that have said I wish they wouldn't have called it that, but it's in fact what it does. It is a it's a protocol of progesterone that they put into the woman's body, and then it in about 60% or so of the cases it can preserve that baby's life. I've actually met children who were born after the mom took the first of those two abortion pills. I've read articles where people have described what having an abortion with an abortion pill is like. And I remember reading one. I can't remember where it was. I want to say it was The Atlantic or somewhere like that. And the woman is describing, you know, what's supposed to be happening. And there's actually a photo or a line drawing of a woman kind of curled up in the fetal position a little bit on the floor. And she said, you know, the problem I had with that drawing when I saw it was I wish there would have been somebody there holding her hand. And my first thought was, why? Why do you need comfort when you're having an abortion if it's just normal medical care and we're not killing human beings? Number two, that woman is going to, depending on where she is in her pregnancy, she is going to deliver a dead child. The first of these pills kills the child. The second of these pills expels the child. Mm-hmm. And chances are great she's going to deliver that dead child into her toilet, where then she will see
the baby's
that
body.
Child. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can read you material, which if you give me just a second, sure. I'll locate it here. If you want to find out exactly what people are going to be looking at, I would start with what Dr. Jerome Lejeune said. He was a professor of fundamental genetics at the University of Rene Descartes. This is the guy who discovered Down syndrome, mm-hmm. The genetic basis for it. This is what he writes. At 2 months of age, the human being is less than one thumb's length from the head to the rump. This is 2 months, 8 weeks.
Okay.
He would fit with ease into a nutshell, but everything is there. Hands, feet, head, organs, brain, all are in place. His heart has been beating for a month already. Looking closely, you would see palm creases. With a good magnifier, the fingerprints could be detected.
Wow.
Every document is available for a national identity card. The human nature of the being from conception to old age is not a metaphysical contention. In other words, it's not just some religious idea. Mm-hmm. He says it's plain evidence. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows this. Mm-hmm. And when I say everybody, I mean everybody. Medical doctors know it. I've got an excerpt here. I keep wanting to read stuff to you, but it's just
okay.
So important good because people do not know these things.
It.
Back in 1970, mm-hmm. there was an essay in California Medicine. California Medicine is the official journal of the California Medical Association. This essay is a pro-abortion essay. I want you to listen to what these guys wrote. Now, it's funny. People say, why would they write this in public? Well, back in 1970, nobody could have imagined
yeah.
that somebody could Google this and
yeah.
find it.
Yeah.
They thought they were just talking to themselves. Mm-hmm. Listen to what they write. Since the old ethic has not yet been fully displaced, it has been necessary to separate the idea of abortion from the idea of killing, which continues to be socially abhorrent. The result has been a curious avoidance of the scientific fact, which everyone really knows, that human life begins at conception and is continuous, whether intra or extra uterine, until death. Who knows? Everybody knows.
Mm-hmm.
The very considerable semantic gymnastics which are required to rationalize abortion as anything but the taking of a human life would be ludicrous if they were not often put forth under socially impeccable auspices. Everybody knows it's a human being. They all know it's a baby. They say, but we have to find a way to overcome that natural intuition that women have, that they're pregnant with a human child.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way we can do it is by engaging in considerable semantic gymnastics.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a fancy word for lie.
Right.
See,
that
rhetoric training comes in handy when you're looking at people's arguments. And then they have to be often put forward under socially impeccable auspices. We have to have the government saying it, the medical community saying it. We have to get the educational system to say it. We got to get the entertainment media to say it. And it'd be really, really great if we could get some churches to say
mm-hmm.
it too.
Yep,
and
absolutely.
Then they did it, and it worked. What worked? Well, they describe it. It is suggested that this schizophrenic sort of subterfuge is necessary. Why? Because while a new ethic is being accepted, the old one has not yet been rejected. Well, what was that old ethic? They identify it in the article. That old ethic was the Judeo-Christian ethic.
Mm-hmm.
The Judeo-Christian ethic that says that every human being
mm-hmm.
has they have an objective moral value. Everybody equally. Why? Because the Judeo-Christian ethic says that you are created in the image of God.
Mm-hmm.
And so is, you know, your producer over here.
Mm-hmm.
And so am I, and so are all of your listeners. Every human being created in God's image. These guys say we have to replace that.
Mm-hmm.
We have to replace it with an ethic that says human beings have relative moral value.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, all animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. They say later on we might have to determine who does and doesn't get expensive long-term renal dialysis,
yep.
for example.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it fascinating. Do you know who they decide, these doctors? Do you know who they say ought to be the arbiters of who does get it and who doesn't? It's doctors.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine that. And they make it clear in this essay that in order to be at the forefront of death selection and death control later, we have to first establish ourselves at the forefront of birth selection and birth control. And they did it, and it worked.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is why we are where we are right now.
So dangerous, the slope that we're sliding down, because in socialized medicine, eventually you have to ration with what you have.
That's correct.
So you will prioritize life from, say, age 3 to age 65 and deprioritize in the pregnancy stage and birth stage through old age where you're just not contributing to the collective anymore. So it's time to just give you some pills and we'll let you fade out, hopefully peacefully. But if we're all created in the image of God, then every life from conception to natural death is important.
That's correct.
That's the biblical view versus this, well, quite frankly, it's just atheistic view.
Amen.
But the reality is, as these ladies, as you've talked about, the rhetoric, so much of it is dehumanizing what they're dealing with.
Yep.
It's terminating a pregnancy, aborting a fetus. No, it's killing a baby.
That's correct.
What we're going to do, lady. We're going to pull this baby. The baby that's inside you, we're going to pull it into pieces. We're going to cut it into pieces, and we're going to lay it out on a tray as if this is another Halloween movie or Friday the 13th
yep.
movie. That's really just what's going on. And I can't imagine what some of these gals that, you know, no doubt, we all have the ability. You look at King David, you recognize you give any of us enough time,
that's correct. Can
justify some pretty bad behavior. But you've got a young lady that's gotten pregnant. She made a mistake, and she's embarrassed about it. What are her parents going to say? Okay, I'll just take this pill and nobody will know. But what's going to happen is when this baby passes out of her, she's going to look in the toilet and she's going to see her son or her daughter entirely dead laying there in the toilet. And then she's going to have to push the plunger and flush that baby. I cannot imagine the harm after the fact, the psychological harm that these ladies are going to be dealing with.
And what's amazing to me is the absolute outright lying that is coming from the media. There was, a California assemblyman, somebody, they released photographs and they said, oh, you know, the pro-life people are telling you it's a baby, but this is what it really looks like. And you know what they submitted? And they knew it was a lie when they submitted it. They submitted a photograph of the sac that the baby is mm-hmm, in, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. They didn't show the baby, right? They chose not to do that. And they did it to lie to people.
Yep.
People do not understand how committed these folks are. It's really interesting. You can go back and watch Senate hearings where somebody will come up and show an ultrasound.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll watch all of the pro-abort people, they'll just lower their eyes and won't look at it. Because they are religiously committed to the destruction of these children. It's amazing when you see, for example, how these kinds of things get reported. This was recent. This is from July 6th, 2023. So just a few days ago. I want you to listen to how CNN describes the heartbeat bill in Texas. So they say, a strict abortion law that took effect in Texas in 2021 may have led to nearly 10,000 more births than expected in the last 9 months of 2022. What a horrible thing. 10,000 babies didn't die but lived instead. And then Suzanne Bell, the co-author of the study, steps up. She studies patterns of contraceptive use and abortion. So she chimes in and she says, there were still a lot of people who are going further afield for abortion care. That's an amazing turn of phrase, isn't it? Abortion care.
Mm-hmm.
Or who were self-managing their abortion. But our results suggest that not everyone was able to overcome those barriers, right? Those barriers to having children.
Mm-hmm.
And so many were forced to carry an unwanted or unsafe pregnancy to term. Oh, my goodness.
Mm-hmm.
Here's it, folks. They had babies.
Yeah.
People have been having babies since time immemorial. The only reason we are here today is because somebody had a baby. The only reason you're here today, somebody had you.
Yeah.
And to treat pregnancy and childbirth as if it's some kind of medical pathology, mm-hmm. this is a new thing, mm-hmm. folks. To have people up on Capitol Hill say that abortion is absolutely health care, that it's the loving option, that the only way to be pro-life is to be pro-abortion. These are the kind of words coming out of these people's mouths. It's only true if pregnancy is a pathology mm-hmm. and unborn children are like tumors or diseases. And folks, if we go down that road, if we start believing that about unborn children, we're doomed.
Well, anybody that's conscience is so scarred that they want to kill an innocent life is willing to lie to you. So that should be pretty easy to recognize. If we're willing to kill you, then we don't have any problem lying to you as well. We just have enough time for a couple more things, but you made a great point last night. I love the illustration because one of the heartbreaking things is there are – now, it's very, very rare, as what Guttmacher Institute themselves reported in their data – the amount of pregnancies as a result of rape or incest are literally fraction of a percent.
Yes.
So it's literally it's the smokescreen for murdering all these babies on demand and what it is. But you had a scenario laid out last night about the three people involved in a pregnancy that was caused by rape.
Yep.
Would you just share that with our audience?
Sure. And you know, before we get there, I want to make it clear. We've got people listening.
Mm-hmm.
You have abortion in your background. Right. Statistically, it's just impossible that the people, all of you watching, that some of you don't have abortion in your background. You've either participated in an abortion or you've had an abortion. And I want to make it clear that the things we're talking about here can be very difficult to listen to. I want to help you to understand. I know that a lot of the folks watching are pastors even, and we have pastors with abortion in their background. You need to find your way through to forgiveness and healing and restoration. And so I want to encourage you, if you don't want to go to a pregnancy center that's in the town that you minister in, go to another town where you could be anonymous and go in and go through their Forgiven and Set Free program and learn how to become reconciled to God over sins of your past so that he can empower you to minister. So about rape and incest, let's take a look. Rape and incest, it is the way that abortion forces are going to try to overcome pro-life laws in every state. How do I know that? This is a book called Handbook for a Post-Roe America. It is written by Robin Marty. Please do not buy this book. I don't want to give her any money, but if you want to get it used somewhere, that's fine. On page number 74, she writes, "Pressuring your legislators to ensure that, at a minimum, victims of sexual assault still have access to abortion care and aren't forced to carry to term just because of the state they live in is not just a reasonable action that reflects the majority's belief on abortion. It also offers a clear, incremental step toward repealing abortion bans as a whole down the road." Rape and incest exceptions are the camel's nose underneath the tent. Mm-hmm. Because here's the deal. If you can say that people who aren't appropriately conceived, right, not in a marriage or not in a long-standing, long-term relationship, or even not in a relationship where people want the baby, well, those people, we're going to marginalize those people. So if we can start by saying, if you were conceived by rape or incest, how you were conceived affects what you are. So now you are this dehumanized non-person. And by the way, the only reason people bring up personhood arguments is to create a category of human beings that it's morally permissible to kill.
Gotcha.
Right? It's the only reason. The fact of the matter is all human beings are persons. Right? Make the Venn diagram, right? All human beings, all of them are persons. So when we address this issue in public, in private and counseling, you do this differently. But in public, if you're speaking and somebody says, well, what about rape and incest? 9 times out of 10, they don't really care about rape or incest. What they really care about is, can I make you look like a moral monster by declaring that you're going to force that woman to have a baby? Okay, I got news for you. From the moment of conception, that woman already has a baby.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's take a look and see. So we always respond when people say, what about rape and incest? We don't start with an argument. We start with compassion. We don't know why they're asking. So you say, look, I think that rape and incest, these are horrible, terrible crimes. If a guy has committed one of those crimes, then if they are caught, if they are tried, if they are convicted, they need to be punished to the fullest extent of the law. Even a violent serial rapist, however, because of Supreme Court case that came out in the late 1970s, no matter how violent the rape, if nothing else happened, if the woman didn't die, that man is not at risk for capital punishment. Got to make that abundantly clear. But that guy should be punished to the fullest extent of the law. But I think it's important for us, when we look at rape and incest and the conception of children, to do what I call count people. So I say, all right, so a man violently rapes this woman, and as a result of that sexual act, a child is conceived. So how many human beings are in this scenario? Right, 3.
Mm-hmm.
Now we'll assign guilt and innocence. So the man who's the violent rapist, guilty or innocent? Well, everybody's going to go, well, guilty. Okay. Now, what about the woman, guilty or innocent? Everybody's going to say, obviously, innocent. Okay, now, we've got this third person, though.
Mm-hmm.
Are they guilty or are they innocent? Well, people go, well, they're innocent. Okay, now let's determine what we should do to those people. So to the rapist, right? Now, I've had people say, especially in a lot of my southern states, kill them.
Kill them or castrate them.
Right? But you can't, right, because the law won't allow that. But punish him, right, to the fullest extent of the law. What should we do to the woman? Oh, we're not going to do anything to the woman. We're going to do something for the woman. She's a victim. Mm-hmm. So we're going to provide her with all of the physical, emotional, and spiritual support she needs, not to get over it, because you never get over it, but to get through it, right? We're going to help her to get through it. She deserves care. She's a victim. Okay, now what about this third human being that we've already identified falls into the innocent category? What are we going to do to this human being? Why is it that this human being in this scenario is the only human being that's actually facing capital punishment? Doesn't seem fair.
Death penalty is not allowed for the rapist, but...
But for the child, absolutely. So what we need to do is we need to provide that child with all of the physical, emotional, and spiritual resources that they need in order to survive. Now, here's the little-known secret about women who have been victims of rape and incest. People have this idea that every single woman who's ever conceived a child as a result of rape or incest has aborted that child. It's not true. I've met many people who were conceived. A good friend of mine, Stephen Holland, who is an incredible worship leader and a vibrant voice for the pro-life movement all over the United States, his mother was gang raped.
Wow.
And but she didn't abort, and he's the result.
Wow.
He's got an incredible testimony, by the way. You got to have him on sometime. The majority of women who conceive children, even as a result of rape, go on to give birth to those children. The majority of the women who give birth to those children choose to parent those children. So this idea that that this is the default position is a lie of pro-abortion forces. And by the way, no, I didn't call them pro-choice. I called them pro-abortion because it's what Planned Parenthood calls themselves now. They say, be proud to be pro-abortion. So I'm going to call them exactly what they want to be called. These people are in favor of intentionally putting to death children in the womb.
Mark, we've had some wonderful training sessions with you, with our congregation, with pastors here in the community. Talking to pastors, we've got some 1,400 pastors that have completed our Liberty Pastors Training Camp watching this at their leisure. How can they get more information about you, your ministry, more information about this subject? And quite frankly, I'd like for you to tell them how they can get a hold of your book, because there's a lot of great information in that.
Yes, they can contact me through speakerforlife.com, S-P-E-A-K-E-R-F-O-R, because I wasn't cool enough to get a number, life, L-I-F-E.com. And there's a contact form there. They can pick up this book. It's called Contenders, A Churchwide Strategy to Unmask Abortion, Defeat Its Advocates, Empower Christians, and Change the World. I've got a new book I'm working on right now called Pivot. If pastors want to come and bring me out, we can do a pastor training. Mm-hmm. We can do an evening apologetics class. All they have to do is contact my office, and then we will find a way to coordinate that and make it happen.
In 60 seconds, tell pastors what they need to be thinking about doing to address this issue in their churches and in their community.
In the beginning part of Contenders, I talk specifically about why pastors don't preach about abortion from the pulpit. I give 8 reasons, 6 of them spoken, 2 of them kind of unspoken. And a lot of pastors, if you take a look at what I write here, you're going to see yourself in some of those arguments. Folks, we have got to come to the recognition that abortion is not a political issue. It is not even necessarily a moral issue. It's an action that results in casualties. In my book, I talk about how it's not like Molech worship. It, in fact, is Molech worship. And the Apostle John tells us, right, to teach our congregants, little children, keep yourself from idols. And this is a bold claim I'm making, and maybe you think, oh, you know, Dr. Newman, you've got no idea what you're talking about. Get the book, read it. Get my friend John Ensor's book on this very subject matter, and you will see that we are in the midst of one of the most titanic spiritual struggles. We make the Nazis look like pikers. We've slaughtered over 65 million children in this country, and we have scarred countless million human beings. It's important. We are the only ones with the answers, pastors. The state doesn't have an answer. Even a state like Tennessee or Texas or here in Oklahoma, where we pass laws, all we can do is make it illegal. We can't provide anything for women who've had abortions. All we can do is make them feel bad, right? A thing that was legal now suddenly is a felony, and they feel terrible. If those people want forgiveness and healing and restoration, they need to be led to confession and repentance. Yeah. And we've got research from Lifeway that says, you know, that 49% of women who come to church, 49% of post-abortive women who come to your church, they do not believe that when you preach about forgiveness, that it applies to a terminated pregnancy.
Wow.
And so knowing that, we have to coordinate with our pregnancy centers. We've got to coordinate with Embrace Grace programs, and then we need to preach the truth from the pulpit so that people will make life-affirming decisions for their unborn children.
Amen. Dr. Mark Newman, thank you so much for being in our church this week. Thank you for coming and sharing on our podcast and on our program today. And for those of you that have interest in this, I recommend going to speakerforlife.com and then also get a copy of this book, Contenders. A lot of the information we talked about today you'll find in the book. Well, thanks for being a part of us today. Until next time, God bless you.
Oh.